Hello, everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast developed and hosted by the American Educational Research Association's Qualitative Research Special Interest Group. I am Jessica Lester, the current chair of the Qualitative Research SIG, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Emma Rowe. Dr. Emma Rowe is a lecturer in the School of Education at Deakin University. Emma teaches and publishes in a broad range of educational fields, including policy, sociology, and pedagogy. She's quite an experienced teacher, with experience ranging from secondary schools, vocational, and university sectors. Emma draws on quantitative and qualitative methods to research education policy, privatization, and the marketization of schooling within a global context. Her research is published in peer-reviewed journals, including Critical Studies in Education, the Journal of Educational Policy, and Discourse Studies in the Cultural Politics of Education. She has published a full-length and solo-authored monograph with Routledge entitled Middle Class School Choice in Urban Spaces, The Economics of Public Schooling and Globalized Education Reform. Emma's research focuses on public and private divisions of schooling, consumerism, and the economics of schooling. Emma is familiar to the Qualitative Research SIG as she was the recipient of the 2015 Outstanding Dissertation Award. Dr. Rowe, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Jessica. It's great to be here.
So as I noted, you were the recipient of the QR SIG's Dissertation Award in 2015. Since then, you've published this book based on your dissertation work entitled Middle Class School Choice in Urban Spaces. To begin, can you share a bit about your dissertation work and the ways in which you engaged with qualitative methodologies and theories?
Yeah, sure. So my dissertation, as you noted, it did become the book. The book is based quite strongly on the dissertation. And so in my work, you know, as you said, it's about middle-class school choice in urban spaces. And I think that that connects quite well. It is my intention, it's my hope that it connects quite well to the qualitative methodologies that I draw on. I try and work towards quite a strong connection in that the contributions are underpinned by the methodologies that I use in terms of the entire data corpus. So my qualitative methodologies, I work towards them being quite visual, contextualized, multi-layered and nuanced as well. So my book explores urban school choice and how the consumer is engaging with public education in the context of the market. So public schools are historically understood as non-market or located outside the purview of the market. This book and this study explores contemporary tensions that are produced by the entanglement of public schooling within the economy. And these tensions are played out via conflict points and consumption choices, and this quite constant, complex interplay between the social democratic collective and education as an individualistic acquisition. And I guess the reason why I'm returning to that purpose is because I'm trying to always make these connections between what the purpose of the research is and the methods that we use to explore our purpose. I think both of them need to be constantly connected on an ongoing basis, I think, to reach this quite nice interplay between them. So the study, it's a long-term 2011 to 2016 ethnographic, and it is mixed methods. I do use some quantitative in there as well. I feel like a bit of a traitor there, but it does use quantitative and qualitative. And to explore these tensions, you know, these conflict points, I wanted quite a nuanced and rich qualitative lens, a lens that paid attention to space and the nuances of space. So I wanted it always to be quite located in where the consumption choices and also those conflict points were happening. So it goes from a global lens to a local lens. Mm-hmm. I studied quite a few social movements and global protest actions around public education, such as the student movement in Chile, the opt-out movement in the US, Occupy and what became Occupy the Department of Education as well. Save Our Schools movement in the UK, the US and Australia as well. That spans three different continents, Save Our Schools movement. So I take a look at these global movements and then I try and shrink it down to the local lens. And with the local lens, the study examines a number of collection action groups, or lobby groups, that are lobbying for a brand new public high school. And that's where the ethnographic data comes into it. I'd say a visual ethnographic data comes into it. And so here with the ethnographic data, that spanned from 2011 to 2016. So it was quite long term that I studied these lobby groups. And I attended all of their meetings. They had monthly meetings. They had events where they were lobbying political groups, really, for a brand new public high school. Mm-hmm. That might get lost a bit in translation, so I probably should just explain that a little bit. In Australia, the government is responsible for initiating brand new high schools. So these lobby groups were set up to lobby the government to initiate and fund these brand new high schools. So these parents are taking on this role to lobby the government and get funding for these brand new high schools. So I go to all of their events, which there are quite a lot of those events, armed with my notepad and my pen. I had their permission. And I took field notes as a participant observer. And so, as you can imagine, this was quite ethically complex and challenging and fraught with methodological dilemmas on a constant basis. Mm-hmm. I also undertook interviews face-to-face and in-depth with those parents who were campaigning for schools. There are quite a lot of these campaigns, so I involved myself in three of them. They're all in a city as well, so they're all operating in these what I call urban spaces. And I collect. They also have quite professional websites set up and Twitter accounts and all those sorts of things, so I collected data from those websites as well. In addition to that, the study generates photographs of all the different neighbourhoods and detailed maps as well of the neighbourhoods with proximity from school to neighbourhood, travel times and things like that, and also statistical data about each one of the neighbourhoods. And that really goes back to the whole idea of it being quite located and with a very keen sense of space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's quite a bit of data and quite a process.
It was a very exhaustive data corpus.
I'm sure exhausting as well for yourself.
Yeah, it was. 6 years of it.
Wow. So you mentioned your engagement with mixed methods. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so with mixed methods, that primarily drew upon, I was geocoding and later I worked on a paper. I said we then because I worked with Christopher Lubienski on a later paper that came out of something like that. So I was geocoding statistics from neighbourhoods. So by looking at school choices and also this quite dynamic campaigning behaviour, looking at the socio-demographics of all the neighbourhoods. So, for example, how many individuals in that neighbourhood were born in Australia and how many were born in other countries and specifically what other countries as well. So we had... what came out was quite interesting. So there were surrounding schools for all of these parents, basically. The parents who are campaigning, there are surrounding schools, and in the surrounding neighbourhoods there were definitely there were quite significant differences in the socio-demographics. So there were much higher proportions of people who were born in other countries In one of the neighbourhoods, there was a really high proportion of individuals born in Vietnam. And then in another neighbourhood, there were quite a high proportions of people born in China. So there were these quite significant differences that came back to these ideas of race and income as well. We looked at levels of income. So we looked at race, we looked at levels of income, and also religion. So we proportions, I considered the proportionality of people who were born, who were in that neighbourhood, who were identifying with a particular religion. And that was quite interesting because the campaigning parents had this really high proportion of no religion in that particular catchment area. It came through in all of the neighbourhoods that were campaigning had this high proportion of no religion, whereas the surrounding suburbs were much higher in terms of religious identification. So that was... That was really the, in terms of the quantitative measurements, there was a geocoding of catchment areas. So mapping catchment areas to the demographics of the neighbourhoods.
That's a really helpful example.
The Qualitative Research Special Interest Group was established in 1987 to provide a space within the American Educational Research Association for the discussion of philosophical, ethical, and methodological issues in qualitative research. We invite you to consider joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group today. For members of the American Educational Research Association, the annual fee for joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group for regular, non-graduate student members is $10, and the annual fee for graduate students is $5. As members of the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group, you will gain access to a network of fellow qualitative scholars, as well as our many activities, ranging from mentoring opportunities to our exciting new podcast series to updates and news related to recent qualitative publications and jobs. Please visit the American Educational Research Association's website at www.aera.net to join the Qualitative Research SIG today.
So Dr. Rowe, across much of your work, which you've already hinted at already, you often engage with ideas that are related to geographies and spatial theories. I recently read one of your pieces where you were theorizing what you referred to as geo-identities, in which you described how geographies may inform identities and school choice. Can you share more about this concept of geo-identities and the ways that you engage with spatial theories?
Yeah, sure. So geo-identity, I feel like I'm still beginning to think about this, but it was a concept that was influenced by my thinking. I was thinking and reading a lot about class identity. I was reading the work of Diane Ray. I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with her, or Mike Savage, the UK sociologist. And they write quite extensively about class identity and how class identities are informed, or how we construct them, and also how that, in terms of contemporary understandings of class, how do we still think about class in terms of it? We've talked so long about the death of class as well. Mm-hmm. So really, if class is dead in contemporary analysis, then how are we going to progress it forwards? Mm-hmm. So geo-identity is basically trying to progress this concept of class identity. So I argue that geo-identity reflects a more contemporary analysis of class structures and class identity in urban spaces in terms of how people are constructing these ideas of distinction and separating themselves. In my own study, participants constructed quite rich class topographies in that they measured their own sense of class in class identity via their urban spaces and urban positionings. This came through constantly. I never introduced the concept of class in terms of interviews or when I was talking to people who I've never used this concept of or word of class, but people often said to me, oh, this is a very middle class area, or the neighborhoods around us, they're not like us, they're not as educated. This idea of where you're positioned in urban space can be incredibly influential for how you think about your own levels of distinction. And this really feeds into how people make schooling choices. I would argue it's really one of the most important indicators for how people are making schooling choices, certainly in Australia, that our class story is informed and located within our landscape, within our urban landscape. Mm-hmm. And it's not only about logistics, it's not only about, oh, it's the closest school, even though that's often what we say, it's the closest school or it's the travel time, it's the distances, but it's actually about the urban landscape. And part of this whole idea of geo-identity is saying that, making the claim that urban landscapes generate their own class story. Mm-hmm. And this is something I pursue a lot more in my work. The urban landscapes are far from neutral territories, but they actually have this very rich narrative and genealogy about what they represent and signify. Some of them have other names. They all have quite rich histories if you talk to the people who live there. So urban landscapes have their own sense of identity, and this feeds into how urban dwellers identify and also how urban dwellers make school choices.
Mm. It's a really powerful idea, and one that I am quite sure will be taken up and explored further by many of our listeners. So for qualitative researchers who are new to thinking with geographies and spatial theories, what would you recommend as useful starting points?
I guess useful starting points. I think that the best way to start is to think about what your epistemological and ontological purpose is for your research. So when you're starting out, think through what you're hoping to contribute, and you know the reasons why. So really come down to the purposes and the aims of the research. I think, you know, I said it a lot in the beginning, is my belief that they should always fit together. Mm-hmm. They should always be quite fluid together. So I think the useful starting point is to think about that. And in terms of the research that you might want to look at, I mean, I read a lot of work by Doreen Massey, which the book For Space I found quite influential. I read a lot of work by David Harvey, especially his concepts around relative space and relational absolute space. There's a lot of work by out of the United Kingdom, a lot of great researchers. And in Australia, Kulevo Golson's work in space is very interesting. Can I promote my own work? I'm not
Absolutely.
Going to.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've written a lot about this topic as well. So my publications are also available. So I guess for me, a useful starting point is always to have quite a thoughtful framework around the purposes of why you're doing what you're doing. I don't think a visual ethnography should just be about being visually appealing and being engaging, even though I think that's a really nice kind of product or a nice what we get out of it. It's good that it's visually appealing, but it shouldn't just be about that. I use a lot of those visuals in my work because I hope that it comes back to my epistemological, my ontological framework about how I'm theorizing my research in that school choice. It's a global reform, but it happens really in the local space. It's manifested in local conditions, and it happens across time, and it happens across space. All consumers have to cross time and space. They either have to overcome it or they have to negotiate it. So I really think that by using these visuals, by using maps, by locating it, I'm hoping that it gives this reader not a, rather than decontextualizing it, it really contextualizes the choices. So we have a hopefully a richer, better understanding of how policies are translating in the local. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So speaking of your work, I recently saw actually on Twitter that you have a call for a special issue. I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit about that special issue so that listeners can keep their eyes out for it. And also perhaps there's someone that might be interested in submitting an abstract.
Yes, we would love to receive abstracts. So I'm really glad you brought that up, Jessica. the title of that is alternatives for the neoliberalism critique. So we're trying to write about what are possible alternatives to critiquing education reform under the neoliberal umbrella, basically. Mm. So if you want to hear more about that, if you're interested in it, if you could email me or look on my, Twitter is where I I publish a lot of these things. So if you could follow me on Twitter, it's Emma Alita Rowe. And it's also published through Discourse Studies in the Cultural Politics of Education. So we would love to receive contributions, and the contributions are coming in. So I think it's going to be a really exciting special issue.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, so you mentioned your Twitter account. I'm quite positive that many of our listeners are going to be interested in following your work. Is the best way to access your scholarship and stay up to date on your research via Twitter, or are there other ways as well?
Twitter is probably quite useful. It's probably the quick way. And also I'm on academia.edu. Are you on academia? Is that familiar?
Yes, it is. Academia.
Yep. And also, as I said, you can also email me. But Twitter and academia is probably the quickest and easiest way to stay abreast of any publications and those call outs and things like that. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Emma, for joining me today. This has really been insightful and in many ways inspiring, thinking about the ways in which qualitative researchers can engage with geographies and spatial theories. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jessica. It's a real privilege to be a part of it.